should have more military exercises with Taiwan, Air Force and Navy in the West Pacific. It's saying that the U.S. should consider and carefully assess the possibility of U.S. naval port visits to Taiwan. So these are all, and you're seeing where President Trump, when he was elected, picked up the phone and made a phone call to Tai. So these are all different ways, more substantively and symbolically, that the U.S. Support for Taiwan has been increasing over time. So with these two factors, though, it makes it seem clear-cut, as if everybody sees the empirics and everybody sees the views of what's going on. But that's all filtered through domestic perceptions. This is where things become more complex and more muddled. Because within Taiwan's domestic politics, especially in a very free and democratic and vibrant democracy, you're going to hear a lot of voices, especially during elections. Because for local politics, anti-Americanism is always popular for local politics. Anti-foreigner is always popular for local politics. Anti-central government is popular for local government. So you're hearing within this freedom of speech, vibrant environment, where there's people who are questioning, is China really the threat? Or maybe China's not the threat. Maybe China's an economic opportunity. Or maybe China promises one country, two systems. And that sounds really good. And it's promising that, you know, we're gonna have our way of life, and then that might be a better alternative, right? So what is the threat, or is it not a threat? And the US, is it really that cooperative partner? Or, as we've seen recently with the passing of a famous local commentator, Liao, where he was famous because he was in Taiwan, and he steadfastly advocated for unification. And he was really critical of the United States. But that's because people who speak with shock value can sell his hundreds of books that he wrote, right? And to make careful analysis and responsible predictions is not going to sell as many books as shock value. So when he says these things, it kind of starts to muddle the picture. Is the U.S. really, you know, a partner? And I wrote an article that's available on the front table called Three Myths of U.S. Arms Sales to Taiwan to kind of argue against these three myths. One myth is that, by bullshit, Taiwan pays the U.S. billions of dollars not to buy the equipment, but to buy insurance. You know, it's not just for equipment, it's to guarantee that the U.S. troops will come to save Taiwan. And I counter-argued against that. Another is that the U.S. sells overpriced equipment. That the U.S. sells the military cheap, U.S. military cheap, and it sells to other countries like much more expensively. And based on my 6 years at the State Department Office of Regional Security and Arms Transfers working these specific issues, I carefully counter-argue against that as well. And a third is that the U.S. only sells outdated and old military equipment to Taiwan in a way that's exploitative, right? And I kind of argue against that because, yes, there is a special program called EDA, Access Defense Articles, where the U.S. transfers older naval vessels, maybe 20 years old, that are still in good operational capabilities, but then it's at a fraction of the price, oftentimes 5% of the original price, 1/20th of that price. But the vast majority of U.S. arms sales to all countries in the world, including Taiwan, are brand new equipment, right? So these myths, though, this is the domestic perception that then muddles this international situation. So you see the threat, and you see the opportunity and the support, but then the domestic politics translates that and muddles it and says, is China really, or maybe it's better to go on China's side, and that really starts to impact the outcome of domestic politics and foreign policy within Taiwan. You get a drink of water.
So for the threat from China, that one's straightforward. Like I said earlier, as China's military becomes more threatening, we should expect that Taiwan's military to become stronger to guard against that threat, to ask the U.S. for more advanced capabilities to guard against that threat. Now the other factor of U.S. support is more complex. It's not as straightforward. It's easy to think that the U.S. should always be more supportive because if the U.S. is more supportive, then Taiwan will be more capable. Like Taiwan will have better defense equipment, Taiwan will be more resolved because it feels like it's backed in the U.S. by the U.S. But does that mean that if the U.S. were to kind of like back away from its support from Taiwan, does it mean necessarily that Taiwan's going to throw up his hand and say, I give up? And I don't think so. I think that history has demonstrated where there are areas where the U.S. was not as supportive over time, that Taiwan then steps up and has greater determination and resolve. So there are some examples from arms transfers. For instance, before George H.W. Bush
decided to transfer 150 F-16 aircraft to Taiwan. Taiwan really struggled. We take for granted that Taiwan has these F-16 right now. But through the late 1980s, Taiwan really struggled to get it to the point where Taiwan developed its own indigenous defense fighter aircraft, saying like, okay, the U.S. is not going to give it to us. We're going to go at it on our own, of course, with some support from U.S. companies in that process. But the same story for missile programs. If the U.S. is not willing to transfer this, Taiwan just say, okay, then we don't need missiles? Or does Taiwan then go ahead and develop its own Zhongguo missile program and Tiangong missiles? Or armored personnel vehicles with this Clouded Leopard, or today with this indigenous submarine program? So that's another variable that's a little more complex than the first one with China. And the one with the third variable with Taiwan's domestic politics, that one really kind of confounds that analysis, because if you're looking at this threat and how to address it, when I did the research for this paper, I carefully looked at Taiwan's various QDR, Quadrennial Defense Review and Military Strategy Reports, just really focused on the threat. Just really focused on, you know, what could China do. So all these things that I'm saying is not what I'm thinking, is what I'm seeing out of Taiwan's official documentation. And throughout that process, though, if there are commentators, especially during elections, in the late night TV call-in shows, where they're, you know, criticizing the U.S. and wondering if things will be better with China, then that really starts to distort the picture. So when I take a look at these key factors, and then I start to imagine, and I've become a little more creative at this point, if Taiwan's military strategy were to become a little more assertive, or a little less, a little more passive, then I became a little creative in thinking of the different scenarios. And the first idea that came to mind of a more assertive Taiwan's military strategy is the Israel model. Because Israel has a strong indigenous defense, IDF, the indigenous defense, Israeli Defense Forces, Self-Defense Force. The Mossad is famous in how they dealt with, famously, the Munich Olympics situation, where Israeli Olympians were killed by terrorists. And basically, Israel's government had a really hardcore response to that situation. So that, I felt, with a higher level of threat from China, if Taiwan were to step it up, I thought it would look like the Israel model, to be a little creative here. If Taiwan were to step down, if either China's threat toward Taiwan diminished, and the U.S. Taiwan felt like it was more appropriate, and it was credible, that China, it's hard to imagine these days, but if China became more liberalized, less centralized, And perhaps then Taiwan, or if Taiwan's domestic politics misperceives the threat and thinks that there's not as much threat, then Taiwan risks Finlandization, which is how Finland dealt with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And the first time I heard this concept was actually through our GTI executive director, Russell Hsiao, back when we were just talking 5 years ago. So that was the idea, and then now it made its way into this NBR publication. And that's the idea in the 1950s, where Finland made a formal agreement with Stalin, the Soviet Union, to defer its foreign policy decisions to the Soviet Union in exchange for nominal independence in its political system. So it's really appeasing, you know, the Soviet Union. So that, I think, would be the more passive direction. Instead of going more assertive, to go more passive. To think about the extreme examples is to take a lot of creative liberties. Academia, and to be beyond assertive to aggressive. The model, I couldn't even think of one in modern times, so I reached into ancient times, 500 BC with Sparta, because that was a culture where a young men started training at 7 years old, and every man is a soldier. So it was a very militant society. So as I thought about, you know, stepping it up. And what if Taiwan was beyond passive to become complacent? You know, then I envisioned this model where, like the Pacific Islands, where they're far from a threat, right? So they don't even need to step up the military. So I thought of Kiribati, pronounced Kiribati, where Kiribati does not even have its own military, it has a police force, because it doesn't deal with a state threat. There are not missiles pointed at Kiribati. It deals with transnational threats, like drug trafficking and illegal fishing and human trafficking. So it has a police force, right? But Taiwan doesn't have that luxury. So as I see these different factors and how these factors come together to these different models, and having some liberty to be creative, I thought of, you know, where Taiwan is right now in the status quo versus where Taiwan could be based on the variation of these factors. But I also want to make a point, because as I talk to people in Taiwan, I often hear the idea of like a fatalist or a complacent idea that maybe it doesn't matter. Like, Taiwan's the way it is right now, but if China promises one country, two systems, and China promises things will be great for Taiwan, let's just go with that. Like, let it be, maybe that's gonna happen, maybe it's not gonna happen, but if it happens, it'll be fine too. And I would caution against that by, as I thought about this issue, by applying the concept in international relations theory, realist concept, of the difference between the international level versus the domestic politics level. So at the international level, it is said, especially in realism, that there's no supranational authority to guarantee the enforcement of agreements. And that's different than domestic politics, because at the local level, if you have a problem or your rights are violated or somebody's breaking the law, you appeal to the local courts or the local government, and if they're doing you wrong, then you go to the state level, mid-level, and if they're doing you wrong, then you go up to the federal level. So there's that hierarchy of enforcement that we see within countries. Right now is an apt time to talk about this because MLK, 50th anniversary, when he had his march on Selma, he had to appeal to the White House because the local levels were not complying with federal constitutional law. And this is 100 years after the Civil War, right? That already determined the role of war freedoms for African Americans. So when you're taking a look at that situation and you see where Taiwan is right now with China, you see that as China makes these promises that, sure, there's the United Nations, but guess who has a veto power at the UN Security Council? China. And even though there are these international institutions, international organizations, there's still not like a world government that can really enforce them. So what China says today can be the opposite of what it does tomorrow. And that's the concept in IR theory. And that's also what we see with China's promises toward Hong Kong 20 years ago, and its actions are looking different than its flowery and rosy promises 20 years ago. And if China says, Taiwan, you know, we want to unify you, take a look at the provinces. There are some positive examples, but there's also examples like Xinjiang and Tibet, and that's a really, really negative example of what's going on today. So as I talk about the paper that I wrote, the factors, the different models, as I built on Professor Bob Sutter and David Gator's paper, and as I segue over to Ian's book, where he talks about China's military threat toward Taiwan, I'd just like to wrap up with the words that I used to wrap up the NPR paper. And that's in looking at places in the Pacific Islands, such as Kiribati, that there are some places in the world that are far from a threat. And for these places, peace comes more easily, more naturally. But for Taiwan, peace only comes through strength.
Thank you very much, David, for taking us through that rather deductive journey of balance of power and balance of threat perceptions, which is all very dear to us IR folks here. All right, and that's a very good segue into Ian Easton, who's going to bring it all together, because he'll be talking about the Chinese invasion threat, Taiwan's defense and American strategy in Asia, bringing together the first panel that focused on Taiwan-US, and then the others here who have spoken about Taiwan's military and political status. So, Ian.
Thank you. Well, very good evening to you all. We are gathered here tonight to assess ultimately the question of how Taiwan's military and national security situation stacks up. Now, this is a very important question, and it's a particularly important question, I think, for college students to explore. Because this is a question that for years, maybe for decades, maybe for a generation or more, we're going to have to assess and then reassess. Because there is no other flashpoint, I would argue, as dangerous as the Taiwan Strait. There's no other democracy anywhere, certainly no other close US security partner and ally, that faces the kind of threat that Taiwan faces. Now, this is unique in the world, and it's unique in the national security perspective, because Taiwan's a country that's not treated as a country. It's a government that is not recognized as a government. If you go across the street to the US State Department and you look at all the flags of all the diplomatic relations we have around the world, you won't see Taiwan's flag. And that's odd, because Taiwan has a defense ministry and a foreign ministry and a presidential office. and a Congress. It's a real country. If you go there and you explore this island nation, and it's remarkable that we don't treat it as such, and there's a remarkable history behind that, why that is. And the main reason why that is, of course, is because of the People's Republic of China and the threat that China poses to Taiwan and the concerns that the U.S. government has over this flashpoint. And so the question really bears exploring of what is Taiwan's national security picture look like today? What will it look like 5 years from now? What will it look like potentially 50 years from now? And what does this defense picture look like? And it's very difficult to assess. Taiwan's military is untried, as is the People's Liberation Army in China. These are unknown quantities. Now, we can quantify the equipment. You can count the number of troops, the number of rockets, the number of ships and submarines. And Rick Fisher did a fantastic job of talking about China's sweeping military modernization program, this massive military buildup, which is aimed squarely at Taiwan. Since 1993, the main strategic direction of the People's Liberation Army and the entire Chinese Communist Party has been on annexing, what they euphemistically call reunifying Taiwan. But we're talking about annexation. We're talking about one country conquering another country the way we saw in the 1930s and 1940s. It's ultimately what we're talking about. And it's such a horrific thought that most people shy away from it. It's difficult to talk about because we're talking about war, the likes of which we haven't seen for a very long time. And it's also uncomfortable because of Chinese influence, the pressure that academics face, that media faces, not only in Taiwan. David An spoke just now about the influence China's political warfare, their psychological warfare, their economic warfare directed at Taiwan. It's not just a defense issue. It's not just a pure military issue. This is a whole of society assault that Taiwan faces from the second largest economy in the world and largest population. This is a national security threat that is unique. And it's an incredible challenge that Taiwan faces. And the fact that the United States does not have a normal diplomatic relationship with Taiwan, that we go out of our way to attack Taiwan's sovereignty, that the U.S. State Department, as they did in January, is removing Taiwan's flag off of the website, really shows you how incredibly problematic our strategy is and how ad hoc it has become and how we as a government, we as a country, just like the Taiwanese and countries around the world, face this stress from China and we react to it, sometimes in very strange ways. So let me talk just a little bit about the invasion threat, because ultimately if we're assessing Taiwan's defense, the ultimate test of that is, will Taiwan survive? Will Taiwan continue to exist as a free, sovereign, and democratic country? Will it still be here 10 years from now, 20 years from now, when you guys in your college and grad school years are hitting the peak of your careers? Will there be war, or will we be able to prevent war and maintain peace? These are very, very important questions. And ultimately, being able to understand the threat that Taiwan faces, being able to understand Taiwan's military strategy, and being able to understand how the two play off of each other and how this dynamic relationship unfolds over time will be essential to answering that question. And it is ultimately an invasion question. It's a question of survival or destruction. And why this matters to the United States, it matters primarily for two very big reasons. One is the geostrategic reason. If you look at Taiwan's location in the center of East Asia and the center of the Western Pacific, Taiwan, right in the middle of the first island chain, it's essential. It is essential. If the United States were to lose Taiwan to a Chinese invasion, it would become extremely difficult, almost impossible, for us to meet our treaty commitments to Japan, South Korea, and the Philippines. Pax Americana, as we know it, as we have known it in the Pacific since World War II, would cease to exist. All of our credibility as a nation would be gone. Our alliances would come unraveled. And that would create a chain reaction effect. So it's important for its strategic location at the heart of East Asia. It's also very important, perhaps even more important, for what it represents as a democracy, as a country that shares our values, that shares our principles, that it is, as General Gregson said, this beacon of democracy. It's a beacon of democracy. There's no other country quite like it in Asia. And it's incredible how it's evolved in this incredibly high pressure environment over time and how quickly it has become such a free country. And if you look at Reporters Without Borders, they track media freedom around the world. Taiwan actually rates more free than the United States now. If you look at Taiwan's human rights record, it's incredible. And it's amazing how fast it's transformed itself. And so it's very important not only for that cold, calculating, geostrategic rationale, but even more so for what it represents as a democracy in this contest of ideology that we face now more than any point since the Cold War, with China being a revisionist power, with the United States now publicly declaring that we are in strategic competition with the People's Republic of China. And that is our number one national security challenge. And it will be a contest that we are likely to face and to struggle with for decades to come. And if that is the case, as I believe it will be, then Taiwan will be something akin to West Berlin. It will be the central battlefield, not just militarily. If we play our cards right, it won't become ever a military battlefield, but an economic battlefield, a trade battlefield, a battlefield of ideas and governance structures. And so it's very important for our own country's national security for all those reasons and many more. So this is a graph of where Taiwan's located in the First Island Chain, and you can see how central it is and how essential it is based on that location. Now, when we talk about an invasion scenario, and again, I think this is a very important topic to talk about because this is what the world's second most powerful country and second most powerful military focuses on. This is the main priority of China's military, is preparing for this potential scenario, this potential operation. This is what we're talking about. This is the battle space. And you can see that in addition to Taiwan proper, the main island of Taiwan, Taiwan's actually more than just one island. It's over 100 islands. And Taiwan occupies islands that are right off the Chinese coast. Now, from the military's perspective, why is that important? This is why. Because before the invasion of Taiwan, the PLA has to move large numbers of troops and equipment to amphibious staging areas across from Taiwan. That takes time. It's something that intelligence can pick up, not just U.S. intelligence, also Taiwanese and Japanese intelligence. And you can see the marshalling of troops at those marshalling areas across from Taiwan. The air bases, the helicopter, army aviation fields, the train depots, the other logistical nodes across from the Taiwan Strait. You can see it. And the Taiwanese can watch it from their outer islands. Some of these islands are just a few kilometers from China. And they can watch this play out. And that gives Taiwan a tremendous strategic early warning ability that they can make a good solid guess, even if all their spies in China are wrapped up in that nightmare scenario where they lose all their human intelligence before an invasion operation. Even if our satellites get blinded, even if everything else goes wrong, you still have a lot of highly trained Taiwanese troops and intelligence officers right off the coast of China, able to listen in to radio chatter, able to pick up what's going on radar, able to see with the naked eye what's going on just across the water. And so that's very important. Now, perhaps this is just my morbid curiosity, but when I lived in Taiwan, I was always fascinated by the question of, in that very unlikely but very horrific and I think important scenario in which China were to invade Taiwan, or even in peacetime when the Chinese think about it, when they assess their invasion plans for Taiwan, and when the Taiwanese assess their defense plan for the island, where are those invasion beaches? And there's 14. And this is where they are. I would argue that the most dangerous are the ones close to Taipei, and especially to the west of Taipei. When you fly into Taiwan, you'll fly into the main invasion corridor. And this is what it looks like. There's Taoyuan International Airport, so for anybody who's been to Taiwan, or for those of you that will go to Taiwan, this is where you fly in. That is located right where the beaches are, the invasion beaches. And because of the immense logistical challenges facing the Chinese military in this scenario, they need more than just those beaches, because these are not Normandy-style beaches. You know, if you go to France, Normandy is 50 miles of massive beaches, completely unencumbered by anything else. Taiwan, you're talking about a few miles of thin beaches. You're talking about very different tidal conditions, very different currents. You're talking about massive mudflats if you get too far south, and obstacles like you wouldn't believe, just natural obstacles if you get too far north. And so in addition to the beaches, there's also the need for the Chinese, and they write extensively about this in their internal literature. There's the need for them to seize airports, strips, airstrips, or runways of Taoyuan International Airport. There's also another old, now retired airbase that exists right next to Taoyuan International Airport. It's called Daoyuan, and that still has airstrips. And also the port of Taipei, to have port facilities that are there that you may not be able to capture intact, because the Taiwanese would almost certainly destroy them if they had to retreat from them. They would destroy it as they retreated to deny it to the enemy. But that could perhaps be quickly repaired. And so this is the battle space. This is where major Taiwanese military bases are. Now, Chinese propaganda would have you believe that Taiwan has no real military. It has no ability to defend itself. All that really matters is, does the United States come to the rescue or not? Well, that's not true. If you read PLA materials, and I've spent several years doing this, it's clear that the main problem the PLA faces is Taiwan's own military. This is what they work on. This is what they war game to. This is what they tailor make their military force to. Yeah, part of their war plan is to engage the United States, the 7th Fleet, and our forces in theater. But the bulk of it is trying to deal with these facilities.